Hello, I'm James Kimarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 10th of December. As a new interim government takes shape in Syria, we have an interview with a rebel commander there, and we hear from one Syrian family still searching for a relative who was imprisoned by the Assad regime. We'll also examine the potential threat from the Islamic State group and ask whether it can exploit the current political upheaval. Also, as the man who's been charged with killing the head of America's largest health insurance company shouts at reporters as he enters court, we speak to a family friend. We hear about a new report into the funding shortage for special education needs pupils in England, and ask whether Edvard Munch was rather more sociable than his famous portrait, The Scream, suggests. The United States has today set out a series of conditions for recognising a new transitional government in Damascus. They include respecting the rights of minorities and ensuring that the country does not become a base for terrorism. It comes as the Islamist rebels who've taken control of Syria are filling posts in their administration. Mohammed al-Bashir, who's been in charge of the rebel-held northwestern Idlib province, has been appointed interim prime minister. In an interview, he has called for stability and calm. But for many people on the streets of the capital, Damascus, the focus is less on the incoming leaders than on the outgoing ones and the new sense of freedom they haven't enjoyed in years.
Only Assad's loyalists could do anything. This would be considered terrorism. Walking these streets would be considered terrorism. These bikes could be considered illegal, and you would be considered a terrorist.
Well, if walking and cycling were off limits, even more deeply suppressed was any talk about atrocities carried out by the Assad regime, such as the chemical weapon attack on the Damascus suburb of Ghouta in 2013. Well, the BBC encountered a man who lost his wife and four children in that attack and has felt he's had to hold his tongue about it until now.
I couldn't speak before this, otherwise the regime would have cut off my tongue. When the attack happened, people started choking and couldn't breathe. My wife and children were killed by chemical bombs.
Well, while there is relief for some, many Syrians are worried about the new administration with the Islamist Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, group at its helm. The BBC's Jeremy Bowen spoke to some of those who are trying to get out of the country as he crossed into Syria at the border with Lebanon.
Talking to a couple of the guys who are trying to get their families out here, there are probably a few thousand people. Now, tell me, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham?
Veriba.
Why? Less, why?
Kill people.
Kill women, kill Muslims, Shia, kill everybody.
Julani?
Yes, not Julani.
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham.
The people with Julani.
Well, in a moment we'll hear from one of the thousands of families also searching for answers. But let's cross live to Damascus and our correspondent, Lucy Williamson, who's there. Lucy, you've been today to what some people call the cradle of the Syrian revolution, just south of Damascus. Tell us about that visit.
Yes, well, we walked into Dara today, and days really after Assad's fall, the mood there was still very jubilant. People waving us past checkpoints, waving our car into the town. I mean, the uprising was sparked there really by the torture of teenagers back in 2011. Among them, Hamza al-Khatib. His mutilated body was returned back to his family, a family that we went to visit today. His mother should have been one of those celebrating the fall of President Assad, but she wasn't celebrating at all. She just learnt that another of her sons, Omar, had also died in the notorious Saidnaya prison in Damascus. She said that she'd been waiting and hoping that he would be released and come home after Assad had fell.
And in the capital today, political developments, the appointment of an interim prime minister, and also, you've been speaking to one of the commanders of the Free Syrian Army, one of the groups, the military groups that was first into Damascus. And what's he been telling you?
Yes, yeah, so he's the new temporary military leader of the province in Dara, Ahmed al-Awda, Free Army leader. He's an English literature graduate who defected from the Syrian army back in 2011 and now leads one of Syria's diverse number of opposition groups. He's different to the group, the HTS, that swept down into Damascus last week, but he did converge on Damascus on Sunday. And I spoke to him a little earlier about what that was like.
I said in Damascus when we entered, we thanked God that we still live to see this moment, this great moment. What we will do now is to live every, let everybody do his job. The teacher, go and do your job. The doctor, the dentist, the engineering, as I told you, to build our country. You can't imagine how much we are happy. We have been crying for 2 or 3 days. You can't imagine what we feel. Everybody here in Syria lost his family.
What happens next?
My friend, I trust in Syrian people. I trust that they will choose their best choice. They will choose the person who will build their country. And I know, and you know, everybody knows that nobody will accept any person who will be a dictator.
Choose? You mean elections?
Of course. That is what we are looking for. The first car entered Damascus. The first step we do, we went to the embassies, to the diplomatic guys. We protected them directly. We took money of the government, the civilian government guys, and took them to the Four Season Hotel. You know, it will be a mad time there. So I did my best to protect everybody there. I don't want to punish them because they choose to be with Bashar al-Assad. They are Syrian.
And that was Ahmed al-Awda, a rebel leader in Daraa, speaking to me earlier.
Lucy, thanks very much. Lucy Williamson there in Damascus with a sense of how things are progressing in Syria. Well, look, on last night's programme, we heard from another one of our correspondents in the country, Barbara Plett-Usher. She was at the notorious Sednaya prison. We heard about there again from Lucy near Damascus. It's where desperate families were hoping to find relatives who disappeared during the Assad years. And we're going to hear now from one of those families. When Sali Deraa's father, Ammar, was imprisoned in 2013 for helping the Syrian opposition by providing food and putting up posters, the rest of his family fled the country. Sali lived in Lebanon and Turkey before returning to Syria in 2018 to look for her father, who the family had heard had been moved from one prison to another. But she's had no luck. I've been talking to her about her search for him with the help of her English-speaking cousin, Dima Deraa, who left Syria at the same time and has settled in the United States. I asked Sali how she tried to find her father while President Assad was still in power.
In the past, they tried a lot to ask about her father, my uncle, but they couldn't really reach to any information that will lead them where he is.
During the days when Assad was in power, how are you going about that?
They were trying to reach out to people who recently released and ask them if they saw my uncle or if they hear about him in prison. And also they tried to reach out to some officers, but the officers, they usually ask about money, a lot of money, and we don't really trust them that they're really speaking the truth.
But I wonder now, since the Assad regime has been kicked out, what have you been able to do?
They have trusted people, went to the prison and look into all the released people from the prison and try to find my uncle, Sally's father, and couldn't really find him. And also, like, they were trying to the released people, because their gestures, their faces change a lot after years in prisons. So they were trying, like, carefully to look into all people to make sure that they know if my uncle is released. They also look into all lists are released from the prisons that has like names of people who were in prison or released or died, and they didn't really find his name in any of these lists.
Do you believe that your father is still alive, Sally?
She's not really sure if he's alive or not. She hopes that he's still alive, but it's been like too many years.
Is not knowing worse than knowing for sure that he is not alive anymore?
She for sure wants to know any information about her father, my uncle. She hopes that for sure that to know any information and instead of just knowing nothing about her loved father.
Dima, if I can ask you this directly, perhaps, because it's your family. What impact has all of this upheaval had on your family, the arrest and the incarceration of your uncle? What has it meant for you and your family?
It was really like a very horrible time. The time we first, not knowing nothing about what happens to my uncle and his family, and then after a week or so, we heard that they are actually arrested. And then we were threatened that they will also arrest us. And we were very, very scared. Like all the family, we left our house. And after 2 days, we decided to leave to Lebanon. We were not prepared for this. I mean, we were just living normal life. Until now, I can't imagine thinking about my uncle and not knowing what did really happen to him.
And the uncertainty, clearly, Dima, is still very hard for you, I can hear.
I mean, I love my uncle very much. Like, I'm looking at prisoners' faces right now, and I can't really imagine what did they do to him. He didn't really hurt anyone. He was very kind to everyone. He was a very lovely person, and he always loved all the kids in the family, all everyone. And he always helped everyone.
And did you hope when you saw what happened at the weekend, maybe when the prisoners came out of that prison, Sadnaya, that he might be among them?
We have like a lot of hope that he is still alive and he's also in a good situation.
Is it going to be easier to find the truth now, do you think?
Before, it's very, very difficult to ask about anyone who's arrested. It's even dangerous. Right now, it's a lot easier, and especially after the prisons are open, we will be able to ask about more information.
And maybe I can just finish by asking Sally, since she's there in Syria, is this just the focus of your life, Sally, just finding the truth?
It's been really very tough 10 years not knowing anything, and they are also trying to release his photo on all the social media to see if anyone have seen him. Like when they release the prisons, if they like see him or they see anyone who's look like him.
Is that something that just would have been impossible in the past?
Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, even for myself, I'm like here in the US, I feel safe. But I am also worried about my relatives in Syria. So I have never been able like to talk about my uncle or ask what happened to him in any like social media websites or looking for him, because I always get worried that, well, if someone knows, something may happen to my relatives, like to Sally or my other uncle or my aunt who are still living in Syria. So we've always been very scared to ask about him.
Cousins Dima and Sally Dera, they're on the continued hunt for Sally's father, Amar. Well, the overthrow of the Assad regime has raised fears of a security vacuum in Syria, which could be exploited by, amongst others, the Islamic State group or ISIS. Israel has used concerns about the security of its borders as a pretext for moving some troops beyond a demilitarized buffer zone between Syria and the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights and for bombing Syrian military sites. Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Egypt and Turkey have all accused the Israelis of exploiting the downfall of President Assad. The UN has called on Israel to halt its airstrikes. Well, there are also 900 or so American troops in northeastern Syria, and the United States has also been carrying out its own preventative strikes on ISIS targets, according to the White House National Security Spokesperson John Kirby.
The counter-ISIS mission by our troops in Syria continues that President talked about a wave of strikes we conducted on Sunday, 75-some-odd strikes on ISIS camps and facilities. You can expect that that kind of activity will continue. We don't want to give ISIS an opportunity to exploit what's going on. They love nothing more than ungoverned space.
Well, we're joined now by Joby Warrick, national security reporter for The Washington Post and author of Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. Welcome to the programme, Joby. Well, what kind of state is that the Islamic State group in at the moment?
Well, it's been on the an upward climb. Just when we thought the Islamic State was relatively contained, and we haven't heard much about them for a while, in the last couple of years, they seem to be mounting a bit of a resurgence. The Pentagon officials have told us that just in the last year, since last summer, there's been a doubling of attacks in Syria and Iraq, which is sort of an area where ISIS operates on both sides of the border. And these are mostly small-scale attacks. They're knocking off security checkpoints and police stations, that sort of thing. But it is growing, and that is a concern because, as you indicated, there is a bit of a vacuum in terms of authority, governing authority in Syria right now. It is exactly the situation in which ISIS tends to thrive. And so there is real concern about the possibility of these guys trying to mount some kind of comeback.
And small scale is not how you describe the American airstrikes, I would assume. 75 individual ones, I think, including F-15s, B-52s. It's a pretty big display, isn't it?
It was eye-opening for sure, and especially when you hear about B-52s. I mean, it's one of the biggest aircraft bombers in the American fleet. And mostly in the past, you know, attacks against ISIS has been against individuals or weapons depots, really small-scale stuff, precision strikes, special forces. And to see those kinds of planes come in and drop their bombs, it indicates to us this is probably as much as anything a signaling, you know, telling ISIS, but also telling everyone else in the neighborhood that we have capabilities. There's a bit of freedom of action that didn't exist in the past because the Assad regime is not there. The Russians are not as engaged as they were. And so let's take advantage of this. I think you see Israelis doing pretty much the same thing, but it did seem to be a bit of overkill as far as we could tell.
Well, you mentioned the Russians. I mean, that's been one of the very interesting things about this part of Syria. It's the Americans and the Russians have both had their militaries operating there.
Yeah, and for the last, you know, since 2015, really, there's been this kind of uneasy, coexistence between the two, because both of these, you know, very major military powers have been operating in the region. There's been deconfliction rooms, officials from both sides, you know, talking to each other to make sure that there's no accidental shoot down of the other's aircraft. So that has gone on for a while, but now we see, of course, the Russians are in a completely different place. They still have military bases. They still have troops on the ground, but they are sort of not the powers in the region that they used to be. So that still has to be negotiated and figured out.
So, what is the fear when it comes to ISIS? Chemical weapons? There are still stockpiles in the country as well, aren't there?
There are, and I think, you know, you can even look beyond those because we're not really sure what still remains in Syria in terms of chemical weapons, but anything that a terrorist group could potentially get their hands on is very worrisome. But it also goes to conventional weapons and, you know, surface-to-air rockets that could shoot down an airplane, all kinds of things that a terrorist group would love to have. And we worry that those are in abundance in Syria and they may be not well secured. So here's an opportunity that a group like ISIS could take advantage of.
And briefly, Joby, we've heard the government in Washington sort of set out these conditions for recognizing an interim administration. How concerned are they about this other group, the HTS, which has been at the forefront of the efforts to bring down the Assad regime?
Well, we've seen Anthony Blinken just today talk about the importance of having, you know, pluralism, you know, multiple, you know, governments that sort of recognize, you know, different ethnic groups, sectarian groups. Whatever the United States is looking for in a future Syrian government has to be inclusive in that way. We're just not sure that the folks that are coming into power in Damascus are frankly capable of that kind of democratic rule, because they certainly haven't been like that in their past. And there's so much we just don't know about how these new groups are going to operate.
Joby Warrick, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks very much. And coming up later in the program.
There was no way I could hang a picture of Munch on my wall. But oh, how beautiful it was. And it was alive.
the bleak charms of the Norwegian painter Edvard Munch, known for works like The Scream, Anxiety and A Separation. We'll speak to a woman whose godmother was painted by Munch to see whether she thinks an upcoming exhibition can find his warmer side. Now, it was quite the entrance this evening for Luigi Mangione at his extradition hearing in Pennsylvania. Handcuffed and struggling in a prison jumpsuit, he shouted at waiting reporters.
Luigi, as completely out of touch, as an insult to the intelligence of the American people, and human experience.
Completely unjust and an insult to the intelligence of the American people. You can just about make that out. The words of the 26-year-old, who has been charged in New York with the murder of Brian Thompson, the CEO of a health insurance company, who was shot dead in broad daylight in New York City last week. Well, Luigi Mangione was arrested at a McDonald's yesterday morning. He was allegedly in possession of a gun and he had been on the run for several days. We can speak to our North America correspondent, Neda Tawfiq, who's covering this case. Neda, he certainly seemed to want to be heard as he made his way into court.
Absolutely. I mean, it was very different than his court appearance yesterday. This time, he almost was defiant in nature, struggling against the shackles and the police leading him in, answering really to reporters' shouted questions with that phrase there. Unclear what he was referring to, but he wanted to be heard. And even during court proceedings, he at one point tried to speak over his lawyer, who told him to remain silent. And ultimately, he was denied bail and chose to fight his extradition, which means it could take several weeks before he gets here to New York City.
Right. So tell us a little bit more about this paper trail of what appeared to be his beliefs and opinions that seem to be coming to light.
Yeah, well, we're hearing more from police that they now consider this three-page handwritten manifesto that he was in possession of as essentially claiming responsibility for the murder of Brian Thompson. They say he expressed ill will towards corporate America, that he referred to insurance companies as parasites, and that he said that he apologized for any trauma, but that it had to be done. And they say he really sees himself as something of a hero. And they are concerned because we have seen the reaction from so many, almost lauding him as a folk hero, as somebody who, you know, gave it back to the insurance industry, which has a reputation, certainly United Healthcare, of systematically denying people's medical claims. And so there's real concern from authorities that people are going to hold him up as some kind of martyr. And that's why Pennsylvania's Governor Josh Shapiro said that he isn't a hero, that he sees him as a coward, and that the employee who called in to authorities as the hero in this case.
So what happens to him now? I think people will be quite intrigued that there are actual extradition hearings between U.S. states. But what's next?
Yeah, it is certainly interesting. We talk about extradition usually between countries, but there is a process. New York's governor has now kind of formally written that extradition request. There is going to be a process that could take weeks here. And, you know, I was speaking with legal experts just about the fact that given his outburst today outside of the courtroom, given his well-documented kind of health issues and perhaps kind of a mental health issues that may have come from that, that he could use a psychiatric defense, that his defense lawyer could be exploring that now. And that would really reduce a potential sentence, for example, from charges of murder down to manslaughter. It could be a far less potential sentence if this does go to trial. So certainly something for his defense team to keep in mind. We just saw a lawyer that he is representing him, at least for the extradition phase. Unclear if he'll continue representing him in New York.
Neda, many thanks. Our North America correspondent, Neda Tawfiq there. Well, I've been hearing more about Luigi Mangione from a family friend, Thomas Maronic. He's a lawyer who worked for 20 years for a radio station in the state of Maryland owned by the Mangione family. And I asked him what he thought when he heard that Luigi had been arrested in connection with the shooting.
When I first heard about it, I saw the last name and I was just shocked because I initially couldn't believe it was the same family that I had known and had been on their station for 20 years. And then I saw it was, in fact, a relative. I couldn't believe it.
Tell us a bit about the family that you know.
The family is very well respected. This is an esteemed family from Baltimore County, which is a larger suburb of Baltimore City in Maryland. They are known for their businesses, which include not only WCBM radio station, but also healthcare, retirement facilities, and they're tremendous donors to charitable causes.
A well-respected and they gave Luigi the best education.
Yes. He was the valedictorian of Gilman. And we still talk about our high school days. We still talk about who the captain of the football team was or the state champion in something. And being the valedictorian at Gilman is a big deal.
Now, you were shocked. What's the more general reaction been in the community, in Baltimore County, especially amongst those that know the family?
There's not only shock, but also a tendency to associate the accusations with the family. And a friend of mine posted on Facebook, and I couldn't agree with him more. He said, "Don't let the allegations that have been made about a member of a family extend to the family." He said, "That's just totally wrong." And I couldn't agree more.
I don't know if you've seen the images from today of him entering this courtroom in Pennsylvania and shouting out. I was going to ask whether this looked like the person that you had heard of, at least.
I didn't see the court appearance, but I'm hearing about it, and it certainly doesn't seem anywhere near the person who gave the speech at Gilman, which I did see. It's just such a stunning transformation based on these accusations.
And people have been looking at what he has posted on social media, what he's written,
right.
And there does seem to be a degree of resentment about the way the healthcare system treats people, and he's had to be treated for a back injury. Does that jar with what you know of the family and their background and, you know, how they might experience the healthcare system?
Not at all. This is something so startlingly different from a family that's been nothing but supportive of healthcare and promoting healthcare access and doing so much for the community. It has no correlation.
And I wonder what you make of the fact that even before Luigi Mangione was identified as the suspect in this case, that whoever had perpetrated this crime was being seen in some quarters as a hero.
It's just awful that somebody who allegedly murdered a man in broad daylight is being seen as a hero. I mean, there are two separate issues. Obviously, the important issue of what United Healthcare was doing and their denial of claims, but that has nothing to do with murdering someone, a father, a husband, in broad daylight. It's something that startled me to such a degree, and you'll probably appreciate this reference, but reminded me of some things that happened in Europe, of the killing of Pim Fortuyn, of the killing of Theo van Gogh, just things that you don't hear about in this country.
Two murders that were carried out in broad daylight in the Netherlands that you referred to back in the 2000s.
Absolutely.
And the fact that so many people seem to have been posting in support of whoever it was who killed Brian Thompson, what does it say to you about America at the moment?
We are a country that needs to get back to the center, and perhaps the actions of some will bring the majority of people in to say, look, this is out of control.
And that was Mangione family friend Thomas Maronic. Over the last decade, nearly half of all the funding for schools in England has been set aside for pupils with special educational needs and disabilities, or SEND in the acronym. £1 billion of the £2.3 billion allocated to education in this month's budget is earmarked for them. But a new report out today from the Institute for Fiscal Studies finds that spending on SEND is becoming unsustainable because of the high needs, and that council deficits could rise to £8 billion in less than 3 years unless there's radical reform to the funding. We can speak now to Luke Sibieta, who's one of the authors of the report. Good evening, Luke.
Good evening.
So what lies behind this? What is the key finding you would point to?
Well, the fundamental thing driving the spending is the fact that the numbers of pupils with the highest forms of educational needs has been rising at a really fast rate over the last 10 years. We've seen huge rises in the number of pupils with autism spectrum disorders, with ADHD, with mental health needs, and also with speech and language communication needs. And some of those increases in need have been really high across the world. So it's not just unique to the UK as well.
Is the way that the UK is dealing with that through school systems particular, though?
So it's not that unusual. So all school systems are facing rising in needs and having to increase spending. The issue, I think, in England is mostly the fact that the spending is statutory. So local authorities have to provide certain forms of provision if they're specified in what's called an education, health and care plan. And so what's been happening in the UK is that we've seen a huge rise in need. Local authorities have to spend the money as specified in the education, health and care plan. Funding has been rising at a fast rate, but it just hasn't met that level of spending need. And so local authorities have been having to spend more than they have and have been running up these huge deficits as a result.
So what remedies would you suggest?
Well, I think there are two main factors that could help with the issue. So they're both of them cost money. So the first is about expanding provision in mainstream schools for people with special educational needs, but it's also going to be about increasing the number of places in state funded special schools. Now those two factors could save money in the long run. However, they're relatively expensive in the short run.
Is one of the two preferable? I think in the budget, a lot of that money is going to places in sort of standard schools, isn't it?
Yes. So the government has a clear preference for increasing the amount of provision in mainstream schools, and that's likely to be the lion's share of what the government does. However, it's probably also going to be important to expand the number of places in state-funded special schools, because there's also relatively high demand. And as a result of that high demand and lack of capacity, the government's been having to buy up quite expensive places in an independent special schools, because it just hasn't got enough places in the state sector.
I put that figure from your report, the $8 billion in less than 3 years going to deficits if something isn't done. I mean, put that into context. How serious is this particular issue?
So it's pretty serious. So local authorities currently have a deficit of around £3.5 billion. We know that spending is probably going to have to rise by around £2 to £3 billion per year over the next few years, which will take us to a deficit of around £8 billion. By law, local authorities aren't allowed to run those deficits. So by law, local authorities should be declaring bankruptcy, but they haven't because the government's passed a law saying that it doesn't matter.
Right. Rachel Reeves is obviously talking a lot about efficiencies at the moment. Is there something that can be done when it comes to efficiencies that would address this or would help to address it?
A little bit. So there's always learning that can be done from best practice across the country. But fundamentally, the number of pupils with special education needs is rising. It's rising in England. It's rising across all high income countries. And that type of provision costs money. And that's the only solution.
Luke, many thanks. Research fellow with the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Luke Sibietta there. Now, A Sick Child, A Vampire, The Crucifixion, and of course, Nature's Scream. The Norwegian artist Edvard Munch is best known for powerful canvases that evoke feelings of dread and melancholy. But an exhibition of his work at the National Portrait Gallery next year is aiming to show his more sociable side, a man with plenty of wealthy patrons rather than a solitary figure screaming into the sunset. Well, is that an accurate description? Can that be portrayed? Joining us to discuss that, Sue Prideaux, Anglo-Norwegian writer. Her biography of the artist is called Edvard Munch, Behind the Scream, and her godmother was actually painted by him. Good evening, Sue.
Good evening, James. So, yes, she was. And she was wearing a chiffon dress. And he painted her outside and he put her against the sun so that he could see through the dress.
Gosh.
And he used to tell the story.
Quite a story. And I guess that was what led you to become so fascinated by him, that personal connection?
Yes, that my Norwegian family had a lot of his paintings, and they, they knew him. They were patrons of his.
Well, that brings us on to this exhibition, which is going to concentrate, we understand, more on those, on some of those patrons and those relationships. What did you learn? What did you know of those sort of relationships that he had?
Well, I mean, he's interesting because he is an introvert, and there was, you know, existential anxiety, but he had the most tremendous gift for friendship, and he was very likable. And as a boy, obviously, his life was very sad. His mum died when he was four, his sister when he was 14, And he had TB most of his childhood. But his school friends and cousins brought their lessons home for him so he could get an education, which is pretty cool, really. And then, when he was 19, he was taken under the wing of the two most important Norwegian artists who got him a scholarship to Paris. And there he saw Impressionism, and he's sort of between 19 and 23 there. We're on portraits. When he saw Impressionist portraits, what he said was, you know, there should be no more portraits of men reading and women knitting, but people who live and breathe and suffer and love. And he says, you know, I want to paint souls. And that's where his portraits come from, how they're, you know, so very different, you know.
And there is lots of suffering. There's lots of love, sexual freedom in his portraits, isn't there? And in terms of, yeah, you know, how we think of him as a result of perhaps his most famous portraits, do you think an accurate impression, if I can use that word?
Well, I think, you know, it's quite tough when you've got an icon around your neck like the Scream, isn't it? And I think that this coming exhibition will show, you know, so much humanity in the portraits. And, I mean, it was rather wonderful towards the end of his life when he had a sort of nervous breakdown and he admitted himself into a clinic. In fact, it was alcoholism. But then, age 46, when he was leaving, he was terrified of coming back to Norway. And he painted 10 portraits, life-size portraits, and he called them the Guardians. And they were his Oslo friends who were going to protect him. And, you know, they stood around his studio. They were his guardians. So he really, really depended on people and loved people, you know, and wasn't afraid of showing that.
Well, wonderful. Let's hope that comes across in the exhibition. Sue, great to talk to you. Sue Prido, Anglo-Norwegian writer, as we said at the beginning, whose godmother was painted by Edvard Munch. That exhibition coming at the National Portrait Gallery next year. Just time for our closing headline tonight. Israel has carried out attacks on Syria's naval fleet as part of its efforts to destroy military assets in the country after the fall of President Assad. It's also hit hundreds of other military targets. The UN has called for the airstrikes to end. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.